Everyone has a story to tell. What's yours? Welcome to the Around the World podcast. I'm your host, Dan Perry. Do you enjoy hearing tales of world adventure? Would you like travel advice from those who know the road well? Maybe you want to embark on a journey of your own, and you just need a bit of motivation to get started. You'll find all of that and more in the Around the World podcast. My guest this week is Chris Jackson from Perth, Australia. I met Chris on the Indian Pacific train, which runs across Australia from Sydney to Perth. Chris was on his way home after having ridden around the continent on his motorcycle for the previous 3 months. When the train dropped us off in Perth, he and his family graciously took me into their home for my last few days in the country. During the interview, Chris and I talk about the geography of Australia, its various cities, and vast wilderness. We also discuss what it's like to hit the open road on a motorcycle. At the end of the interview, Chris talks about his time spent volunteering with an Aboriginal group. It takes me a few minutes to find a good rhythm, but bear with me. Chris is a fascinating person, full of knowledge about his country. I had a great time talking with him. Let me know what you think. I'm sitting here in Perth, Australia with Chris Jackson, and he has just come back from a long road trip around his native country of Australia. And what did it last, Chris? About 3 months?
Yeah, just over 3 months.
Wow. And you drove a motorcycle all the way around the country?
Almost the whole way around.
In a big loop, is that right?
In a big circle, yeah.
Cool. I mean, Australia, I've been here for a couple of months now, traveling around this country as well, and I've found that hardly anybody lives away from the coast. Almost everyone's near the ocean. It's just a big desert in the interior. And so is that kind of how the road system works here?
Yeah, more or less. Especially over in the west, there's pretty much one coastal road and one inland road. It's a little bit more options over east, but yeah, that's basically the gist of it.
And it's, wow, I mean, just to think about that, are those the paved roads or sealed roads?
Yeah, they're the sealed roads. There's some other smaller roads, but they won't take you the whole way around generally.
Okay. Yeah, and so we met on a train, actually, coming from Adelaide to Perth, and that we saw, like, nothing. I mean, I was blown away that there's this whole vast land of absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
For a couple thousand kilometers or miles, I mean, days of it.
Yep. So there would have been the Nullarbor Road that would have run parallel to the railway, which would have been sealed, and maybe like five roadhouses.
Wow.
And that would have been about it for a big section of that.
So just places to fill up your gas tank and continue on. Yeah. Wow. I mean, just to imagine that this is a country as big as the United States, or at least as big as the lower 48, and with only 22 or 23 million people, so 1/15 maybe of the population of the U.S., and almost all of those people are along the coast, so it's amazing, enormous just to think about. So I was really happy to be able to cross the country overland from, well, really all the way from Melbourne to Perth on a bus and then a train. I think a lot of people would fly that whole route, but I love seeing it just to grasp how big this place is.
Yeah, it definitely gives a lot more perspective.
Yeah. So, but the majority of your trip was on a motorcycle, right?
Yeah. So I did maybe 23,000 Ks or so all up, and almost 16,000 Ks of that was on a motorbike.
Oh, like 2/3.
Yeah.
Okay.
So there were a couple of sections where my motorbike was broken down or whatever, and I took a bus for a little while and came back to the same place, or the last section from Adelaide to Perth where I took the train. But the majority was on a motorbike.
Wow. What kind of bike is it?
It's a Suzuki V-Strom. It's a pretty common touring bike. It's a big upright adventure tourer styled bike with some two pretty large panniers, 25 litre panniers and a top box on the back.
Okay, so plenty of room for gear.
Yeah.
And how big is the engine again?
It's a 650 cc.
Oh, okay. So
it's a bit of a mid-range. They make a 1,000cc model as well.
Okay.
But I figured for petrol conservation purposes,
yeah,
that the 650 might be the way to go. So
there you go. It's so powerful enough to get you along those rough roads, but not so much that it's burning fuel like crazy.
Exactly. Yeah, and it is. It's quick enough. Like in Northern Territory, there's some sections up there that don't have speed limits. So
really?
It gave me some opportunity to test out the speed there.
And pretty straight roads to kind of...
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So I got up to about 165, fully laden with all my gear, you know, which is quite resistant to wind and heavy and all that. So I reckon it could crack 200.
Wow. Well, 165 anything. Would be about 100 miles an hour, I think.
Yeah, so 100 miles an hour is 161 k's an hour. So it's just over 100 miles an hour.
Wow. Yeah, wow. And that's not even illegal to do that.
And it wasn't illegal to do that, no. Okay. I think in general, their outback roads are 130 k's an hour, but they do have those sections of whatever.
Really? Oh, I didn't even know that. And
130, I don't know what that'd be like. 85 miles an hour?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that seems fairly safe on these roads that are just empty. Hmm.
Yeah, when there's no one around. You can, like, on those roads, you can travel for an hour easy sometimes and not see anyone.
Wow, yeah. Well, are there, like, kangaroos jumping at you all the time, or is it...
Yeah, so kangaroos, a lot of, in fact, in Central Australia especially, a lot of Australian animals are basically nocturnal. So they'll, especially kangaroos, for example, they'll come out dusk and dawn.
Mm.
That's when they're most active.
So that's when you have to worry about them most.
So basically, I just don't ride my motorbike at those times.
Okay.
I mean, there were multiple instances where I almost did hit animals. The worst ones are kangaroos and emus. They just jump out in front of the equivalent, I guess, of your deer.
Oh, yeah, we have white-tailed deer, and where I'm from in Wisconsin are a big problem.
Sure. Yeah, emus are worse than kangaroos, I reckon, even.
Emus are kind of like ostriches.
Ostriches, yeah.
A little, maybe a little smaller?
I'm not sure, really.
But they're native to Australia.
Yeah, but similar looking and flightless, big flightless birds.
Big dumb animals, huh?
Yeah,
just jump
small,
in front of
small heads, small brains, just run around on the road.
Yeah, just waiting to get creamed.
Mm-hmm.
So you almost hit a bunch of stuff, but luckily no major collisions.
No collisions at all. It was all safe for the trip.
Wow. But a lot of hot weather is that what most of Australia is? I mean, we're here, now it's summertime. It's, it's February, and you were traveling, what, December, January, February?
I left in beginning of November, and got back early February.
Okay. So just coming into summer and much right in the middle of it.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't the ideal time if you're going to travel Australia on a motorbike, but unfortunately that was the time I had off. So it was the time I had to go. But it depends where you are, really. Up north in Australia, it's all tropical. So as I was coming into there, I was coming into the wet season. So I needed to try and get through that as quickly as possible while still seeing things, so I didn't get stuck in bad weather. You can, if you're unlucky, actually get stuck in even major towns like Darwin. You can get stuck there if it gets flooded, the roads get flooded and things, you can't get out of the town.
I've heard, I was kind of discouraged from going to Darwin, which is right on the almost northernmost point of Australia in the middle.
And that's a capital city, so
wow,
it's funny that something like that would be so isolated. So pretty much from, I guess... Broome, which is in northern Western Australia, all the way through to Cairns, which is over Eastern Australia in Queensland, Northern Eastern Australia. All of that is all tropical, monsoonal.
Yeah, so you got to watch out then for massive rainstorms. I mean, I've been in the middle of some tropical storms, and it's incredible. I feel like I could step out of the rain and jump in the shower and I'd get less wet doing that. Like how heavy the rain can be. It's just amazing.
Yeah. So as I was actually mentioned, in northern Queensland, there's a place called Cape Tribulation. It's not actually the most northern part of Australia, but it's probably only another 500 kilometres or so off. I'm going to keep using kilometres. In that particular place, there was a half-hour period of rainfall, which delivered half of the yearly annual rainfall of London. So in half an hour in this particular location.
Half an hour.
Half an hour. Half of the rainfall of London.
Of what London would get in a whole year. Wow, and London's considered to be a really rainy place.
Exactly. So it's not unusual in this particular place in one day to outdo the annual rainfall of London.
My God, that's insane.
So yeah, on a not on their worst years, but on a bad-ish year, they'd get about 7 meters of rain.
7 meters,
yeah.
And that's, I don't know, 23 feet or something. That's wow. That just sounds like an enormous amount. And I normally, like I was even saying before, I think of Australia as this big desert and not much going on. And
I think that's a pretty common, I guess, misconception that even Australians have.
Okay.
That Australia's just purely desert. And Central Australia, that's definitely true. It's just dry and red dirt, and that's it. And things just don't survive. But yeah, definitely, it definitely changes depending on where you are.
Wow, I mean,
a lot.
So up north you can get massively rained on, and it's interesting. This is the majority of the news that I hear, at least concerning climate in Australia, is like there's huge droughts and water shortages, and maybe that applies to some of the cities that are along the southern coast. Like Perth has some problems, right, with water?
Yeah, we have water restrictions and things.
Okay.
We don't have problems in the sense that we would turn in on our taps and we wouldn't get water.
Uh-huh.
But we do have water restrictions, so you're only allowed to water your gardens and things like that a couple of times a week.
Okay.
So certain rules that are in place.
Okay.
We also have recommendations that we should follow and things like that as well.
Okay.
But I think that's pretty common just in terms of water consumption.
Sure. So it's not like massively affecting your life or
in a negative way. No. Not in Perth. But in some places, certainly.
Okay. Yeah, in Adelaide, when I was there, which is on the southern coast, people were talking about, I think, a level 5 restriction, they were saying. So they actually have levels. Where they were telling me, you're allowed to shower, you're allowed to use the toilet and drink, but that's it. And if you get caught watering your lawn, you get a big fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, at least at certain times.
Okay.
So it sounds like it gets pretty bad in some places.
Yeah. No, definitely. I was like, for example, in the same place I was talking about, Cape Tribulation, where they have 7 meters of rainfall per year.
Yeah.
Before their wet season kicked in, they had a particularly late wet season and they were jumping in the shower for 5 seconds, scrubbing up with soap, then putting the shower back on again and washing off all the soap.
It's like military style. Then.
Exactly. Yeah. So, they were running out of water before those 7 meters came in.
Oh, man.
In a few months.
So they don't have a way of storing all that water that gets...
They have multiple rain tanks and rainwater tanks, yeah. But it's just because their season started so late there.
Yeah. Okay.
Wet season started, I think it was about almost 2 months, like a month and a half after they usually get it. Basically they just started running out of their stores.
Wow, just cut them off
guard. They needed to be a little bit more careful.
It's a country of such extremes in that way that they just don't get any rain the rest of the year when it's not rainy.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just totally dry or totally wet.
Dry up there, but it's I haven't actually been there during their dry season, but apparently it's just like awesome weather.
Just
like perfect, 27 degree sunny.
Okay.
So, yeah, okay.
Beautiful. Yeah,
27 degrees.
27 in Fahrenheit would be like high 70s.
So it's just like really nice weather.
Wow. Well, that's cool. So that would be like July, August-ish?
I think so. Basically, their dry season goes from... Well, their wet season goes from October to March, generally, and dry season for the rest of the year.
Now, is this kind of information that you're giving me, did you know that all this before you left, or is this kind of stuff you pick up as you go?
Yeah, I definitely picked up a lot of information as I went.
Yeah.
I knew the general gist of, I knew up north was tropical, central was hot, coastal was kind of ideal living conditions most of the way around. I knew those types of things, but specifics I definitely picked up along the way. I learnt, a whole bunch of random facts and
that's cool. I mean, I love that stuff too. It's like, it's one of the reasons I travel, like learning the stuff that seems kind of boring to talk about this in school or something, but when you're out there on your motorcycle experiencing it, I mean, did you get caught in any of these rainstorms? Did you manage to avoid them?
Yeah, I got caught a few times. The places I got caught were generally places I wasn't expecting storms. So up in Darwin, they have about 4 rain storms a day during their wet season.
Okay.
But they're just like 5-10 minute storms.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I managed to, you know, I got caught out of them a few times, but not, you know, just walking around the city or whatever. I got caught out in them.
Oh, walking. Okay. But what about on your
motorcycle? On my motorbike, I tended to avoid them up there. Uh-huh. The times I did get caught in storms, I had to pull into, you know, just random places to stay and things. Were generally, as I was coming down the eastern coast, and even as I came inland a little bit, when I was expecting the weather to start improving from that northern monsoonal area, the further south I went, the unluckier I got with the weather and just started running into some storms. Also, Central Australia, I ran into some storms. I reckon it would have been the only time, probably in the last 50, no, I don't know, the last, I don't know, they probably get rain a few days a year type thing, and I managed to run into some rain there.
Wow.
The day before Christmas, Christmas Eve, which is dry. We should be dry because obviously our seasons are reversed to yours. So that should be at the, you know, beginning of summer. It should be dry. As managed to run in a couple of storms there. So just, yeah, I did, but just unlucky ones really.
I guess I'm curious about your route now that you're kind of talking about these random places. Mm-hmm. You live in Perth. You grew up in Perth, right?
Yes.
On the west coast, southwest.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's not in the tropics. Then you started out by going north along the coast,
mm-hmm.
up to Darwin, which is the very northern, not the most northern, but toward the northern part of the country,
mm-hmm.
in the center, and then around to Cairns. Is that right?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, the route you can't really take exactly. You can't go Perth, Darwin, because there's no road that goes directly that direction.
Oh yeah, that'd have to go straight to the country.
So I basically followed the coast, came inland a little bit in Western Australia,
mm-hmm.
Went back out to the Western Australian coast, followed that around to Broome. Now, Broome's actually the most isolated township in the world, furthest from any capital city.
Oh, that's an interesting stat.
Yeah, so...
how big is Broome?
Broome is... so it's got a population of 18,000 people during its wet season, so of a living population, but it boosts out to about 60,000 during its... or 50 to 60,000 during its peak tourism season. It's a very touristy, that's how they make a lot of their money.
Yeah.
Because of, I guess, the remoteness of it. And it's quite a nice place. So a lot of people go there to get away.
Mm-hmm.
So it's 2,000 kilometers from Darwin,
which
is the next capital city, and about 2,000 kilometers from Perth as well.
Oh, right in between the two.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I mean, I hear a lot of people talk about Broome and a few other cities that, just by the sheer number of people who mention them to me, or how many times I hear these names, I just assume they're really big places.
Mm.
But that just sounds like just kind of a small town.
If you compare it to a lot of Australian towns, you get populations of, in some places, you get very, very small populations, basically.
Yeah, okay.
So 18,000 is actually quite a reasonable size for an Australian town out that remote.
Okay.
And anyway, then I continued around, went up north to Darwin.
Uh-huh.
I actually then flew. I left my bike in Darwin for a little while.
Okay.
I actually flew down to Alice Springs, which is in Central Australia, near Uluru, or Ayers Rock, as a lot of people might know it. Uluru is the correct name, the most politically correct name.
Okay.
And then from Uluru, or from Alice Springs, I went up north on a bus back to Darwin, just so I could check her out around all that area.
Oh, okay, see the scenery.
Yeah, so I took a bus up to, back up to Darwin and collected my bike again.
Okay. But so look back to Uluru, that's it's a sacred rock, is that right, of the Aboriginal people?
Yep.
It's a huge, huge rock that it's kind of a famous photographic thing that you've seen a lot of pictures.
I'm sure a lot of people would have seen photos and things of it. It's a big red rock. It almost looks like it has a bit of a plateau on the top. It doesn't really. It does have a curve over the top of it. But, yeah, basically a big red rock. I think it's 342 metres high or something like that. So it's not massive, but just because of how flat everything else is, it really kind of looks a bit out of place. It was originally made from being pushed up out of the ocean back, you know, hundreds of millions of years ago, and it was much, much taller. Wow. There's actually landmarks in that area that are actually bigger than that, that I think are actually cooler, but much, much less famous.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, maybe we can make them more famous. What are they?
There's one called the, again, the politically correct name is the Katachuta.
Katachuta.
Yeah. Okay. These are mostly Aboriginal names. Hmm. So that's why they might sound a little bit unusual. But the name that, I guess, white people gave to it was, the Olgas, O-L-G-A.
Olgas. Okay.
Yeah, the Olgas, which again, is probably a more commonly used word, uh-huh. But Katachuta is the politically correct.
Okay. This is another big, mountain or monolith.
Yeah. So a similar type thing, big rock formation. This one is a bit different in the term, like, Uluru is a big, one big rock that has a flattish top, almost like a,
like a plateau, like a
trapezium almost.
Okay. Trapezoid. Like,
yeah. So, but whereas the Olgas are kind of, more bouldery, I guess, but they're, almost 100 meters taller.
Oh,
there you go. Much more impressive as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, so go to the Olgas.
Yeah.
If you're coming to Central Australia.
Yeah.
There you go. So, let's see. So, was the reason for leaving the bike behind just because you didn't want to ride it all the way down and ride it all the way back?
Yeah, it is a big distance. It's about 1,500 kilometers, which is, I guess, 900 miles.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's about half, it is about half the distance from the top of that area of Australia to the bottom of that area of Australia.
Uh-huh.
Because
it's right in the middle of the continent.
Yeah, it actually is. I think it's only about, because they have done calculations to figure out the geographical center of Australia, and I think it's only within 100 kilometers of that. Uh-huh. So it's quite close to the center of Australia, Alice Springs. So it was just to mix it up a little bit and also to save the bike a little bit. It's not the greatest roads. Alice Springs isn't the safest town to leave a bike around in as well.
I see.
Basically mix it up and all that type of stuff, and then bust it back up to grab my bike and continued on the journey.
Okay.
By coming south and then east again.
Okay.
I didn't have to go quite as south as Alice Springs, obviously.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Because there's that peninsula that juts up, and that's where Darwin is.
Yeah.
Okay. So back south to the main kind of coastal road, and then
it's an inland road.
Oh,
so we're talking Central Australia now. It's an inland road that goes almost directly south, and then east, jutting out from that road, T section is a road that goes over and ends up in Queensland at a place called Townsville.
Okay.
Another
small town.
Yeah, so bigger than Broome. Townsville is actually, I think, almost the same size as Darwin by memory.
Okay.
I think it's a decent population of maybe 100,000 or something.
Oh, okay. That's pretty big, yeah.
Nice place, actually. I had some motorbike problems there. I had some in Broome and some here in Townsville. So I left my motorbike there for a little while as well, getting fixed up in the mechanics.
I guess that's almost to be expected on a really long journey.
So it was for a general service and to have the fuel pump replaced.
Wow.
And then I figured my bike was going to be in the shop for, I think it was a week and a half or something.
Okay.
So I took the bus up to Cairns and Cape Tribulation, places I was talking about before.
Mm-hmm.
And then the bus back down again to collect my bike and continue coastal.
Yeah.
All the way coastal down through until about Sydney. And then a little bit inland to go through the Snowy Mountains and Mount Kosciuszko, which is the tallest location in Australia, 2,228 kilometres. Not quite. 2,228 metres.
Yeah.
So 2.2 Ks. Down to Adelaide. Down to Melbourne and then through to Adelaide and then across back to Perth.
Wow, so that big circle.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and that's your 3-month trip. Mm-hmm. And did you feel rushed during that? Did you kind of feel like that was the right amount of time to do it?
If you wanted, you could spend, I met lots and lots of people taking it 2 years to travel Australia. So, I mean, 3 months is definitely enough to give you a good gist of what's going on in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like I was definitely taking my time all the way through until the East Coast. Unfortunately, that was when it started kicking in that I needed to move a little bit quicker to start getting around. Because obviously I have other obligations in my life. Yeah. I've got to get back to uni and things like that.
Oh, yeah. So you had kind of a hard deadline to get back to go to university. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was when I started picking up the pace a little bit. But, you know, there were places through that area that I would have liked to spend more time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, lots of, like, world-class beaches along that coast, right?
And, yeah, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, Western Australian beaches are pretty awesome.
Ah, okay. You might be a little biased, but...
Maybe a little bit, but... yeah, I guess for in the New South Wales, so I guess the southern area of the East Coast, quite nice beaches through there. Queensland, it's a bit unfortunate in a lot of places. So basically from Broome on the West Coast, north and West Coast, from Broome through to Darwin, and even over in Queensland when you get over to there, you can't swim at any of the beaches because they've got crocodiles everywhere.
Oh, God.
yeah. And then Queensland also has stingers, which are, there's two different types. There's the box jellyfish and the irukandji, both of which are quite poisonous. Box jellyfish will kill you and irukandji will make you very, very sick.
Wow. Okay. And these are really common along those coasts?
You just don't swim. They have sectioned off areas sometimes of beach that they've scanned for these things where it's much safer, but they still recommend wearing what they call a stinger suit.
Okay.
Which is basically like almost like a wetsuit that covers your head and things as well so that if you do get stung, so that you can't get stung, so it just attempts to sting your suit.
But you just walk out of the water and I'm just picturing just these jellyfish just clinging to you and just dripping down with tentacles. And, maybe not quite that bad.
But. Well, in these safe areas, I think you'd be okay.
God.
I mean, and these irukandji, the little ones, they're actually only about an inch.
That's all? And they'll kill you?
They make you nauseous, but you don't even feel the sting. They make you nauseous and sick for weeks and weeks until you get... The box jellyfish, the ones that kill you, they're about 20 centimetres to 30 centimetres long.
Okay.
But their tentacles are a bit longer, so...
Oh, that's just the
actual body.
That
was the body, yeah.
Oh, wow.
So those ones are a bit more obvious.
Yeah, those are pretty big. I mean, that's just one thing I think of when I think of Australia, is all these dangerous animals. Just,
yeah.
You got the crocs in the water, you got the crocs, you got the sharks, you got the jellyfish.
Yeah.
Traveling around land, there's snakes, a lot of snakes.
Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely a lot of different things that can hurt you, and it's not, I guess, just limited to the animals either. In Queensland, up in the rainforesty area, which is actually the oldest rainforest, oldest continually growing rainforest in the world, 130-plus million years old.
Wow.
But up in that area, they have these trees called stinging trees.
Stinging trees?
Yeah. But they're bad. If you get stung by these trees, apparently it feels like getting burnt with hot acid, as well as being getting like having electric current pass through your body at the same time, and this pain lasts for months.
Oh, really?
Apparently, it's not uncommon for this pain to last between 3 and 6 months. And this report of a guy saying it lasted for 10 years.
Oh no!
So it's very, very painful. You do not want to touch these trees.
You have to touch the tree.
You have to touch these trees. They don't move or anything like that.
They don't, like, run after you.
But if you were to fall into the tree or not recognize this tree, because it doesn't look like they would see. They look like normal trees.
Oh, so they don't have, like, needles sticking out of them or anything really obvious?
No, like, no. It's just... Yeah, I think they've got a... Yeah, they just look like the rest of the trees in the rainforest.
Oh, wow. You just have to know what they are and avoid them.
Basically stick to the boardwalks when they're available. Okay.
Yeah.
If you're going bushwalking by yourself... Definitely learn to recognize them.
Wow.
You can learn to recognize them, but to an untrained eye, I mean, you wouldn't know the difference.
Okay. I mean, I've done a fair amount of walking just in the areas of Australia I've been in, which is mainly Tasmania and Victoria, and the trails tended to be really nice, well laid out, a lot of signs, good, a lot of, they call it duckboard or kind of wood that covers the swampy areas so your feet don't get sucked in.
Yep.
It's really, actually quite nice and good. And so I wasn't, like, super worried or anything, but definitely, there's all these things that you can't touch and you have to avoid.
Yeah, I think that tends to be the case. I think most of the time trucks are pretty well laid out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if you're thinking about doing what they call bushwalking here, or trekking or tramping through the wilderness, don't be afraid of it. Just kind of stick to these tracks if you're new at it.
Yeah.
Hmm. So I guess we've talked about your whole journey. I'm curious about your motorcycle riding history. Did you always, since you were a teenager, have you always been interested in riding a motorcycle?
Honestly, I'm actually quite new to bike riding.
Okay.
So I'm 23 now.
Okay.
I got my first license. I got my L plates, my learner's permit, when I was 21.
Oh, is that normal in Australia?
I think you can get it when you're 17.
17, okay.
But I just wasn't interested. I originally got motorbike license so that I could get to work cheaper.
Oh, okay.
I could park for free.
Yeah.
So just to save myself money, basically.
All right. That's one good reason to own one.
Yeah, it was just a little bit more convenient. Mm-hmm. And then I had we have two classes of motorbike license. Basically, on your first class, you can ride smaller motorbikes. Mm-hmm. On your second class, you can ride bigger motorbikes in general. So I had my smaller motorbike for a year, and then I went for my next test. I bought my motorbike, and I think about 2 weeks later, I left on this journey.
That's it. Wow, so you had almost no experience.
On the big bikes, yeah. So okay. I definitely had a pretty steep learning curve ahead of me, learning how to ride a bigger bike, especially when it was top heavy and laden with all my gear.
So did you carry a tent with you or lots of camping gear?
So basically on my motorbike, I had the top box, the two panniers, which are the side boxes. I had two sports bags or duffel bags. I don't know what you would call them.
Yeah, duffel bags.
Duffel bags, yeah. And then a guitar on top of
that. A guitar.
All strapped down, which I leaned back into like a backrest almost. And then a small tank box, they're called, which I guess motorbike riders would be familiar with, which is basically a magnetic bag that would clip down onto my tank in front of me, which could carry valuables and things like that.
Oh, I see.
And, so in one of my duffel bags, I carried a tent, just a sleeping bag, a sleeping mat. I was originally going to carry what we call a swag in Australia.
Oh, right. Yeah, I slept in a couple of these.
Yeah, so
I think
swag is definitely something different in America.
Yeah. Oh, right. Swag means, it's kind of a verb there, but in Australia it's this...
So it's kind of like a cross between a one-man tent and a sleeping mat. Sorry, a sleeping bag. It's kind of an all-in-one type thing. It's basically a roll-out mat that has a cover on it. You just grab it off your bike, roll it out, and jump in it and sleep there for the night.
Yeah, so you're essentially sleeping under the stars, but you have a little mat under you.
They're really cool, actually. But it was actually bigger than my tent and things, so it was just a bit too cumbersome to take.
Right, yeah, they're a little bulky by today's camping standards, I guess, but I can definitely see how, like, 100 years ago or back further that they'd be super helpful.
Yeah, and they are really, I find them really comfortable. I like sleeping underneath the stars, so I do like them.
Uh-huh.
And you can get smaller ones than my one as well, so if I had the opportunity to take it rather than the rest of the stuff, I would have done, but it was just too big, unfortunately.
Hmm. But you took a guitar with you too.
Yeah.
So you must be really into guitar if you...
Oh, not really, to be honest. Oh, so really? I'm trying to learn. I'm trying to... Yeah, it was more just to keep myself company when I'm camping all the way around the West Coast and all that. I ended up using it as a bit of a memento as well. I got it signed by people I'd met along the way.
Wow.
It's a little half-size guitar.
Okay.
I got it for $25. The Australian dollar and American dollar aren't too different at the moment, but I think that's probably
$20 American. Yeah. Wow, I'm looking at it right now. I'll definitely put this in the show notes, a picture of it. But it's a small blue and black guitar with signatures all over it.
Yeah. A few on the back as well. But that's what that was.
So overall, you were by yourself?
Yeah, especially on the western coast. I was just camping, often in not in campsites, often just on the side of the road, just pulled into the bush a little bit, into the scrub, or the sticks, as we call it.
Okay.
Pulled up, set up my camp. Okay. Just chilled out by myself.
It's kind of clandestine camping, like not necessarily
sometimes I'd camp in campsites. It just depended how I was feeling. And, just kind of took it as it came. And, so a lot of the time I was by myself over that side. And the East Coast, I decided to mix it up with a few more backpackers and things like that. I camped a little bit still, but, I think the West Coast and the East Coast are different lifestyles in Australia, so that's why I decided to mix it up a bit.
Sure, and the West Coast definitely more remote than, right? I mean, the East Coast seems populated.
By
comparison.
Yeah, so in Western Australia takes up about one third of Australia, as far as size goes.
And that's the state of Western Australia.
We have eight states and territories in Australia.
Yep.
A couple that are called territories, and the westernmost state takes up a third of that size. So it's the biggest state by far in Australia, and it has a population of 2.55 million people. Wow. Whereas the total population of Australia is about 23.5 million.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
So you can see how it's definitely skewed over to the East Coast.
So you've got 10% of the country in
one third of the size.
Yeah, and you were saying before, just the state of Western Australia is like three times the size of Texas.
Yeah. It's to huge. Give you a bit of perspective, yeah.
Yeah, really massive. With only 2.5 million people.
Yeah.
Cool.
The population of Texas is though.
Yeah, I don't know either. Many times that, probably more, definitely more than even Australia, I would think.
Yeah, okay, yep. Wow.
It's one of our most populated states.
Yeah.
Anyway, I guess I'm wondering then, with so few people living there, did you meet a lot of other people on motorcycles or just traveling?
Yeah. So a lot of motorcyclists will tend to camp and things in places because for some reason a lot of them tended to be older. I guess the backpacker lifestyle wasn't really for them anymore, so they tended to camp there were probably ones that I didn't meet so much, living in the pubs, the hotels and things along the way. So not hotels, but like motels, I guess.
Yeah.
And pubs and things like that. So, so the ones I did meet would tend to be camping. I guess there's a bit of a culture within motorbikers, to kind of be friendly with each other, even on the road, so give each other a nod along the way. I met a number of motorbikers doing the same thing as me, sometimes most of the time in the reverse direction. It's actually more fuel efficient to go in the reverse direction to what I did, which I knew before I left, but because of the seasonal changes, I had to go the direction I did. It was definitely interesting to see other people doing the same thing. Got a lot of tips and things of where to go, where the good riding was, all those types of things.
Okay. Good free places to camp, that kind of stuff.
Yep.
Yeah, just the advice that travelers tend to share with each other along the way.
Yeah. And I guess when you're meeting people on motorbikes, then the advice is generally a little bit more specific and relevant.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. Just to that, I guess the next thing I'm wondering, so you talk about biking and how you had almost no experience before, and that's pretty amazing that you just kind of jumped right into it. But was the trip itself something that you had planned for a long time, or was this just kind of a spur of the moment? Or?
Not a long time. I think I probably started planning it at earlier that same year.
Okay.
Because obviously I need to save for it. I'm a student, so it takes me a while to save money.
Oh, okay.
Because I did have a couple of jobs, or a few jobs, but even still, I wasn't working big hours. I got paid okay, but as far as student wages go, obviously it's not a full-time job, so it does take a while to save money.
Sure.
So, yeah, basically that was the amount of time that I spent preparing, and I didn't want to prepare it too much, but it wasn't a long-term goal or anything like that.
Okay. Well, it's really cool that you're able to save money on a part-time salary while going to university all at the same time.
Mm.
I don't meet too many people who are able to do that. Usually they're just completely broke. I mean, I know I was in college. I had nothing until I got out and got a full-time job. So that was pretty cool. Have you done a lot of traveled to other countries, or was this kind of your first big adventure away from home?
Yeah, so I've done travel to other countries with family when I was younger.
Yeah, okay.
Quite a reasonable number of countries and things like that. So, so I'd done a little bit of other places. I always knew that if I was to do some sort of traveling by myself, I would like to do it in Australia. I definitely think it's important to check out your own place before checking out other people's. I think it's a bit embarrassing when you, if you were to come across backpackers from America or Europe and they know more about your country than you do.
Oh, sure.
So I definitely wanted to make sure I knew what I was doing.
And the reverse is true, too.
Yeah.
I meet people all the time like that where they say, wow, you've seen more of my country than I have.
But yeah.
Then I have that happen to me where I say, well, you've seen more of my country than I have. I don't really know why that is. I guess we figure we can just visit these close places whenever, and so we just never do it.
Exactly.
Whereas once
you take it for granted.
Yeah, for sure. And once you buy that plane ticket, if you're American or Australian, to another continent, you're just on that other continent, and you kind of just have to start traveling.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And it just all comes up.
Yeah, you don't have a residence there, so you can't just
stay
it in one place like you can at home. But
right, and you probably don't know anybody. You probably
can't
just hole up somewhere and not do anything.
You may as well move around.
Might as well, yeah. It's just throw yourself in. But it sounds like that's what you did with your own country, which is great. I mean, good on you for doing that. I don't meet too many people who do that kind of thing first. So do you have aspirations for going to other countries? And
I think I'd like to do a little, especially because I had to skip that southern section of here. So if I was to do a little bit more traveling, then I'd do that section first, check out Tasmania, check out the south coast that I've skipped, maybe do a little bit more of the east coast in the places I'd checked out, but not for long enough, maybe. and then, yeah, I think it would be nice to travel to other countries. I haven't really done a whole lot of research into where I might like to go.
Okay.
So, I couldn't tell you where, but I think that would come after Australia.
Okay. Wow. So you still want to, even after this big trip in Australia, you still want to do more of Australia?
Yeah.
See more of it.
So I've done quite a decent amount of travel through Western Australia.
Yeah.
Even prior to this trip.
Okay.
So I do some volunteer work up north in an Aboriginal community that I've been up to a couple of times, and we go out bush with them and seen some pretty cool stuff up there. And then I've done involved in the Duke of Edinburgh Award, which isn't very popular in America, but it is in America. So some people may have heard of it.
Oh, what's that?
It's an international youth award. So there's about 1 million people doing it worldwide.
Okay.
And I got my gold award a few years back, but I've stayed involved in the award, running it for other people. And I actually went to South Korea with that just before this trip. I literally had 2 days between South Korea and going around Australia.
Oh, God. So, we've done that whole whirlwind thing.
Yeah,
packed exactly. Everything at the last minute.
So I've done a little bit of other travel through Western Australia with Duke of Ed as well.
Yeah. Well, what do you do with Duke of Ed? What kind of stuff do you do?
There's urban sections to the award as well. So it's broken up into different sections. There's a sport section, a community section, and a skill section, which you have to dedicate time to each week and log those hours and things. But then there's also an adventure section and a residential project section, which is where people do their traveling. So I've done some walking tracks. There's a big track in Western Australia called the Bibbulmun Track, which is 1,000 kilometres long.
Okay.
Takes the average person 1.4 to 1.6 million steps to do the whole thing.
Yeah.
I didn't actually do the whole, I haven't done the whole thing, but I've done sections of that with the award. I take other people out.
Oh, you walk with people and show them this track?
I do now. For when I was doing my award, I also did that same track. And now I take other people on that track.
Oh, so the award is partly just a personal challenge?
And
partly helping other people? Is that right?
So the award itself is a personal development award, I guess, in general. But because now I've already got my award, uh-huh. and I'm involved in the award in a different... So I'm an award leader now, basically.
Okay.
And now I help other people get their awards, so that's why I take other people out.
Oh, all right. So you go walking with them or do the urban stuff too with whatever...
Yeah, I generally help them with the adventure stuff. Most people can, you know, do a sport every week or whatever without help, basically. So it's for the adventure stuff that I'll give them a hand.
Okay.
And then for my residential project, I went up to a place called Exmouth in Western Australia. I went swimming with whale sharks and kind of got involved in the community up there.
Wow, yeah. I wanted to go see some whale sharks in Honduras, but... didn't actually see any.
Yeah,
I was in the Bay Islands.
Such an incredible experience.
Yeah, they're huge.
Like, yeah, they're massive. I can't remember exactly how big they get, but it's
like the size of a bus, basically. I mean,
yeah, they're really, really big.
and they're sharks, not whales.
But they are
not particularly dangerous to humans, right?
Yeah, not unless they accidentally hit you with their tail or something.
Okay. But they're not going to try and eat you or anything.
No, they can't eat you, in fact.
Okay.
They don't have the right equipment. But yeah. The only danger is literally because they could knock you out or something if they accidentally swam into you or hit you with their tail. But yeah, not a danger to humans other than that.
Okay. Wow, and I guess being knocked out while you're already underwater is probably not a good idea.
Yeah, definitely keep your distance. Probably keep a few meters away from them. They swim pretty slowly for their size.
Okay.
Generally speaking, they can swim quickly, but they take their time most of the time.
Wow. Sounds like a fantastic experience. Mm. Now, the other thing you touched on that I think we got to come back to is the Aboriginal community that you volunteered for. Can you talk about that a little bit? What did you do?
Yeah, so...
Or where was it, first of all?
Yeah, okay. So it's up north. There's a little... tiny place nearish to Broome, which I've mentioned, called Derby.
Derby, okay.
Yep, D-E-R-B-Y. And then there's a bunch of communities. Aboriginals often will live in these little communities with people from the same backgrounds as them. So this particular community was having a lot of problems with alcohol abuse and suicide especially, and just abuse and things like that. So a group called the Boab Network decided to go up there and provide some of the kids with role models and try and get them becoming, I guess, cornerstones for their own community and empowering them to try and succeed in their lives and do the best they possibly can for themselves. So Derby's about 10 kilometres from this community. It's called Mowinjum.
Mowinjum?
Mowinjum, which is an Aboriginal word, of course.
Uh-huh.
What does it mean? It meant something like, I can't remember, it's something like home at last or something like that, isn't that what that means in that particular Aboriginal language. There's many, many Aboriginal languages throughout Australia.
Okay.
Every tribe back in the day had their own language.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, ironically, Mowinjum actually did move about 20 years ago, so they called it Mowinjum Home at Last.
Yeah.
And then they moved.
So they weren't actually Mowinjum.
So it wasn't quite correct, but
basically. Maybe they're Mowinjum now.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Cool. So did you go out in the bush with them? And
Yeah. So what we actually did with them? The first time I went up, this group goes up periodically, probably four times a year. Sometimes they bring some of the kids down to Perth, and so it's good to go up regularly so that you can build a rapport with the kids. That way they can start aspiring, hopefully, to become like some of the people in the group. So I went up. The first time we went up, we would run activities with the kids, get them out doing things. Often there's not a lot of things to do up there.
Mm.
So they'll go to school, and a lot of them just don't go to school as well.
Wow.
But they're supposed to go to school. And then after that, they'll just have nothing to do. So that's why a lot of them will turn to things like alcohol and drugs and things like that to give themselves something to do with their time, especially since some of them don't have the best histories. Some of them have poor upbringings. I mean, this obviously isn't the case for everyone.
Yeah.
Some of them have fantastic upbringings and
live
awesome lives and all that. So, basically, we get involved and we were running activities with them. We would try and teach them some skills every now and then. So we'd sometimes run cooking classes. A lot of them don't have the best diets. So we'd run cooking classes, get them eating some healthy foods. We'll take them down to the pool. That's another important one. A lot of them will go swimming in the river. But if they're not strong swimmers, that could potentially be dangerous for them.
Sure.
Generally, a lot of the things they do is they just learn on the go. Which is fine most of the time because they're very, very switched on kids and they can learn on the go. But something like swimming, it's good that they have some sort of an understanding of swimming. So we take them down to the pool. It's also very hot there. So I was in there in January and it was 44 degrees every day.
Oh, my God.
Which is...
probably 112, I'm going to guess.
Yeah,
Fahrenheit.
It's hot.
Wow.
Yeah, and we take them out to the pool to get them to cool off and teach them some swimming skills and things like that as well. The second time I went up there, actually, we did go out bush with them, which was, such a privilege, really, because there were 44 of them and 6 white fellas, as they would say.
Yeah.
So us from the network, and we would, it was really awesome. We got to visit some of their sacred caves. This is when we went out bush with them, we went to one of the elders in their community. He has his land.
Yep.
So it was his cultural land. And we got to check out his land, see some of these sacred caves. We went fishing with them. We got to do all the things that they would have done in their own time if they were in their element, I guess. They really do enjoy going out bush. It's their background. It's what they came from.
Yeah. So did they teach you a lot of this? Or was it more like you teaching them or them teaching you or kind of both?
We were the guests in that instance.
And you were welcome guests. They were fine with having you.
They welcomed you. Asked us to come along, yeah. In fact, the elder who owned the land, asked if us, the same 6 people, he asked if we could come back another time.
Oh, wow.
He was definitely happy to have us.
Definitely then.
Yeah. And he told us some of, what they call their dream time stories.
Okay. So let's explain what dream time
is. Yeah. So, that's their spiritual belief of how the lands were created in general. So they have stories for how rock formations were created, from how animals were created. Some of these stories are not for outsiders to learn.
Oh, okay.
No matter how welcome a particular outsider is, even though we were quite welcome, we could not learn these stories, for example. And some of them were only for males to learn. Some of them were only for females to learn. I can give a little story.
Yeah, why don't you give us one of the stories? As long as it's okay for everyone to hear this
one.
This one's
one of the ones that people are allowed to hear.
Okay.
We have a bird called a magpie, which is a black and white bird. Hopefully I get this story right. Basically, this magpie got a thorn caught in its... back in the day, they think magpies were white.
Okay.
All birds were white. So this magpie got this thorn stuck in its foot.
Okay.
And it was trying to get this thorn out, and it couldn't get it out.
Yeah.
This magpie was starting to swell up and had to get all these other birds to come over and start pulling at this thorn. And eventually all these other birds managed to yank this thorn out of this magpie. And the blood from the magpie splattered everywhere.
Huh.
And covered all these birds, and that gave all the colour to all these birds. That's why all these other birds are all colourful in Australia, and the magpie is black. So maybe the magpie was black, sorry. Maybe I screwed that up a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, so basically that's how all these animals got their colors. That's the story of how birds got their colors, for example. Okay. And different tribes would have had different stories for different things.
Sure.
And, you know, we learned heaps of those types of stories, but even traveling through Alice Springs with Uluru, there's stories about how that was created, how the Bibbulmun track was created, which is the track from through Western Australia that I mentioned before. They have things called storylines. Okay. So as people would travel from one place to another, some of the Aboriginals were nomadic. So as Aboriginal would travel from one area to another area, they would teach their younger, the younger people in their tribe different stories as they went along, and they would get a bigger picture of their whole storyline.
Okay.
As they went down.
Yeah, and obviously this is all oral history. They didn't have a exactly. written language, right?
No,
so they just had to pass these stories from generation to generation.
Exactly. Yeah. So the male grandfather would teach the male grandson.
Okay.
The female grandmother would teach the female granddaughter.
Okay.
And the parents would be out hunting and gathering.
Oh, okay. While they're out working, then these kids are growing up and learning the stories.
Exactly. And, okay. So the Aboriginal elders were the most important people in Aboriginal culture.
Yeah.
The males were more important than the females.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the younger females were the least important people culturally for them.
Okay.
And it wasn't just about learning the stories either. It was also about learning about bush tucker, which is bush food.
Okay.
How they can find food. It was about learning how to survive as well, which is more important, I guess, than their, or equal, probably for them equally important to their spiritual beliefs.
Yeah, just survival in the bush, anywhere. It's just something that's so lost to most Westerners in our societies.
And the Aboriginal people were the masters of it. They could find, like, we would look at a cave and a bush and see a cave and a bush, and they would look at it and see a pharmacy and a grocery store.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure they had all kinds of medicinal...
So they, I know that there's a book's written, like, 100 purposes for one tree.
Wow.
There's a thing called a ghost gum tree, which is a eucalyptus tree. A eucalyptus tree is probably one of the most common trees in Australia. Mm-hmm. And they would use the dust on the outside of this tree as a sunscreen to protect them from the sun.
Oh, okay.
And then they would also use this same tree for other things as well. They'd use things, I can't remember other uses for this particular tree, but, you know, they'd use different things for weapons and for eating and for medicine, lots of things.
Wow. So, well, it sounds like you're really interested in Aboriginal culture and learning about it.
Mm.
I think a lot of people outside of Australia, even worldwide, would be interested in this kind of stuff. Do you have any recommendations where to get started? Like let's say you come to Australia,
mm-hmm.
you've never been here.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine you can't just walk into one of these communities and just say, hey, how you doing?
No.
You got to get invited.
Exactly.
Okay. Are there easier ways for maybe beginners to just get a taste for this?
Yeah. So, definitely. I mean, these communities are their houses. You wouldn't walk into someone's house and just start asking them questions. So it's the same thing basically for them. But in terms of just learning some of the basic stories and learning about Aboriginal culture, there's cultural centres often, scattered around Australia.
Yeah.
I did a bit of a tour out of Alice Springs to go check out, because I didn't have my bike at the time and it was a distance to get to Uluru and Cabatuta. So we took a bus tour, to get to these places, and I learnt a lot of things just on that tour.
Okay.
The biggest national park in Australia is called Kakadu. It's in Northern Territory, which is the northern, central northern territory or state in Australia.
Right.
And this national park's almost 20,000 kilometer squares, 19.8 square kilometers. And they do tours through there. You can learn a lot about Aboriginal culture through there. It's a very spiritual place. So a lot of these major spiritual areas, so Kakadu and Uluru and Cabatuta, all of them are kind of spiritual centres, and you can learn a lot from going to those types of places. But even just cultural centres, I mean, I'm sure you can, if you were just interested in the stories or what they did, you can find that type of stuff on the internet even,
yeah.
if you're just interested in that type of stuff as well. They have books and things that Aboriginal people have written,
okay.
If you're interested in those types of things as well. I couldn't name any, but they do.
Okay. Well, the artwork is really cool, too, to just check out.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah, and I'm sure a lot of people would want to do this, want to read a book or look at the artwork. But then it's just something else when you come to a place and you can actually see it and smell it and experience it with your own eyes and your own senses. So I'm sure a lot of people would want to do that. So you think just go to Alice Springs and sign up for a tour?
That's definitely
the best way to get started.
Yeah, it's definitely a good way to get started. Is it the best way to get started? I'm not sure.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's definitely a good way to get started.
Oh, it's really cool, though, that you've gotten this kind of in-depth experience with this community. And definitely, do you plan on going back or continuing this kind of...
With the community that I've done the work in?
Or any other one? Or plan to continue?
Yeah. So I've built up a bit of a rapport with some of the kids. Uh-huh. And definitely, I intend to go back at some stage. I have friends in the network and also in the community. And, I see no reason why I wouldn't go back.
Right. Well, so you brought out, what is this?
Yeah, you're talking about Aboriginal artwork. So I've just grabbed what's called a boab nut. It's a boab tree is a big rounded trunk tree in northern Western Australia. And it grows a nut. The one I've got is probably about, I don't know, it's quite a small one. It's probably only about 8 centimetres tall, so maybe
5 inches maybe.
Yeah, sorry, 5 inches
yeah.
tall. So maybe it's a bit taller than 8 centimetres. But, basically it's been carved by an Aboriginal person with different bits and pieces. So it's got a... obviously you guys can see it.
I'll put up a picture.
It's got a snake, a goanna, which they hunt. They hunt snakes as well. And then it's got a boab tree as well.
Mm.
All carved into it. It's a pretty cool little boab nut, I think. And that's one example of Aboriginal artwork. They obviously have their paintings. They have their cave drawings. They have decorated... nowadays, they have decorated weapons, didgeridoos. So definitely some cool Aboriginal artwork out there.
Yeah, and this probably serves more of a purpose beyond just artwork, right? It probably helps to tell these stories.
Yeah, so especially in their cave drawings and things like that,
yeah.
they'll tell their stories through their artwork. And that's how some Aboriginal culture is remembered. And also, I guess basically that's the gist. I don't think this particular boab nut tells any story. It's just some of their animals that they would have hunted and
cool.
And partly for aesthetics and
that. And was that given to you as a gift or
this one I actually bought. But I know a couple of people. There's a couple of world class Aboriginal, one especially the one world class. Artist in this Aboriginal community that I was talking about who did some work for the Sydney Olympics in 2000, and he helped with their Aboriginal display and things like that, and he actually gave a boab nut like this to one of the people in our group, which she would regard as her most treasured possession.
Wow, I bet. Yeah, a guy of that caliber, and that must be some gift. And
yeah,
It's pretty cool that you can do that, and it's cool to hear that, like, despite all of this, there's been a tragic history with Aboriginal culture. I mean, you could probably compare it in many ways to Native American cultures that have been just destroyed, but it's cool to see that Australians, outsiders, are becoming interested in this, and hopefully that continues.
Yeah, I think it's definitely very sad history.
Yeah.
And hopefully there is a lot more, friendliness between the two cultures as future progresses. But
yeah, I mean, I hope we can learn from our mistakes and just try and make the best of the situation. But it's been a great discussion, and we should wrap it up here. motorcycle talk and gotten into the Aboriginal. That's really cool, and it sounds like you have a lot of varied interests, and I'm really impressed by your ability to pull these numbers out of your head that I assume are real and accurate.
Yeah.
Statistics and population.
Yeah, no, hopefully they're all correct. I'm sure most of them are pretty close.
Yeah.
All correct.
Yeah, and it's a really cool story that you've done this grand adventure around your country, and it sounds like you have many more to come, and maybe venture out further in the world, and who knows, maybe we'll run into each other again.
Yeah, cheers for the talk.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode of The Around the World Podcast. For more information, you can visit my website, 1000daysbetween.com. That's the number 1000daysbetween.com. From there, you can sign up to get updates from this podcast delivered directly to your inbox. Remember, The Around the World Podcast is all about meeting ordinary people who have done extraordinary things. Thanks for listening.